The scale of the Pacific Ocean was past imagining to Magellan. It encompasses one-third of the Earth's surface and covers twice the area of the Atlantic Ocean. It extends over a greater area than all the dry land on the planet, more than 63 million square miles. Magellan anticipated a short cruise to the Spice Islands, followed by a longer but untroubled voyage home through familiar waters. He believed that his men had learned from their ordeals. The mutinies had weeded out the faint of heart and the uncooperative. The crew, once numbering 260 men and boys in 5 ships, was now less than 200 in 3 vessels. Trinidad, still the flagship of the fleet, Concepcion, where Juan Serrano ruled, and Victoria, under Duarte Barbosa's command. The days at sea went by in a trance throughout December. On December 18th, 1520, Magellan changed course. At this point, they were between the mainland and the Juan Fernandez Islands, which lie roughly east of what is now Santiago, Chile. Their new course took them west, away from South America into the Pacific. Soon the mainland, hardly more than a smudge on the horizon, disappeared from view, increasing the crew's sense of isolation and anxiety. If there was ever a time for a monster to appear on the horizon or for the ocean to boil, this was it. Nothing quite that supernatural occurred. Instead, the Armada encountered a different kind of miracle, the steady trade winds at its back. The wind still lacked a name, and the crew did not realize how extraordinary this current of air was until they had experienced it for some weeks. As they reached higher and higher latitudes, the Pacific, so forbidding when they first encountered it in the south, gradually metamorphosed into an undulating silken sheet. As the fleet worked its way north, it was getting the benefit of some of the steadiest winds on the planet. A succession of placid, soporific days ensued. For hours on end, the waves slapped rhythmically against the hulls. The sails sighed and swelled contentedly in their fittings, and the seamen spent their idle hours playing card games or sleeping. Pigafetta, short on patience, diverted himself by attempting to converse with their captive, cooperative Patagonian giant. In the process, he became the first European to learn and to transcribe the Tehuelche language of Patagonia. Exactly what dialect the Patagonian giant spoke is unknown. Despite their limitations, Pigafetta's vocabulary lists rank among the expedition's most significant discoveries. They lacked the commercial value of spices or gold, or the prestige of conquered territories, but they marked the beginning of the modern study of linguistics, and to later generations of scholars, they offered clues to the migrations of various tribes across the South American continent. Pigafetta described the modus operandi that evolved between the two of them. When he, asking me for capac, that is to say bread, and oli, that is to say water, saw me write down these names, and afterward, when I asked him for others, pen in hand, he understood me. Their collaboration resulted in a phrasebook called Words of the Patagonian Giants. Hour after hour, the tall, bronzed, clean-shaven, nearly naked Patagonian huddled in earnest conversation with the much shorter and paler European in his breeches and loose-fitting shirt, scratching eagerly with his pen, gesticulating, querying with his hands and fingers. The two of them engaged in a game of mutual comprehension, surrounded by an ocean of incomprehensible dimensions. Pigafetta was plainly delighted by the captive's range of vocabulary and his willingness to follow directions. At the same time, he was pleased with his own ability to capture the Tehuelche language on paper. Displaying the transcriptions to the giant, Pigafetta introduced the Patagonian to writing, and the power of the written word to speak silently across widely separated cultures and ultimately across time. Pigafetta also introduced his cooperative prisoner to Catholicism. Pigafetta recalled, "I made the sign of the cross and kissed the cross, showing it to him. But at once he cried out, 'Setebos!' And he made signs to me that if I made the sign of the cross again, it would enter my stomach and cause me to burst." Setebos, Pigafetta learned, meant the great devil, the opposite of everything the cross represented in Christendom. The giant intuited that the cross represented a spiritual power, and eventually Pigafetta persuaded him that it symbolized a source of strength rather than danger. At about that time, the Patagonian began to weaken and fall ill. No one could say what afflicted him. Perhaps it was the change of diet, or a virus he caught from the Europeans. The sicker he became, the more he relied on the cross. Pigafetta gave him a real cross to hold, and, as instructed, the giant brought it to his lips, seeking its strength and healing power. But the illness worsened, and it became apparent that the giant was dying. The conversations turned to religion, and Pigafetta persuaded the prisoner to convert to Christianity. He was baptized, and the giant, whose original name Pigafetta never mentioned, became known as Paul. He died shortly thereafter, a Patagonian Christian who met a unique and tragic fate. Pigafetta did not record what kind of funeral rites Father Valderrama accorded Paul, but presumably he was given a proper burial at sea. Although the weather remained perfect, the winds strong and constant, the armada failed to encounter islands with the food and water needed to sustain life. The ships had passed east of the Juan Fernandez Islands, then north of the Marshall Islands, Bacar, Bikini, and Eniwetok. Had their course varied by only a few degrees south, they would have been able to explore Easter Island, or, farther west, the Society Islands and Tahiti. Had their course varied by only a few degrees north, they might have eventually encountered the Marquesas, or Christmas Island. At the same time, the ship also narrowly avoided marine hazards, such as razor-sharp reefs, that could have sliced their hulls. A roaring surf concealed subsurface coral towers. Magellan ships passed within 100 miles of such hazards and emerged unscathed. Even if Magellan had known of their existence, he would not have felt any special urgency to land on their shores, for he expected to reach the Spice Islands or some other point in Asia within days. Headed toward an illusory destination, the fleet remained isolated in the Pacific, 3 little ships suspended in an infinite cerulean sea. Thirst and hunger tormented the crew. Pigafetta chronicled the appalling deterioration in their food supply. "We were 3 months and 20 days without getting any kind of fresh food. We ate biscuit, which was no longer biscuit, but powder of biscuits, swarming with worms, for they had eaten the good. It stank strongly of the urine of rats. We drank yellow water that had been putrid for many days. We also ate some ox hides that covered the top of the mainyard to prevent the yard from chafing the shrouds, which had become exceedingly hard because of the sun, rain, and wind. We left them in the sea for 4 or 5 days and then placed them for a few moments on top of the embers and so ate them. And often we ate sawdust from boards. Rats were sold for 1/2 ducato apiece, and even then we could not get them." The rats commanded a premium because sailors believed that eating them might offer protection against the disease they all feared, scurvy. Scurvy posed the single greatest danger to the health of the men during the voyage. There was no known cure, and if unchecked, it could claim the lives of them all. Magellan's only defense against scurvy was an assortment of folk remedies. Once scurvy struck the crew, the voyage became a race against death itself. One by one, the men began to suffer from the disease. A sense of exhaustion gradually overtook the men, and their gums began to feel sore and spongy. When they pushed with their tongues, even gently, their teeth wobbled. As the disease progressed, their teeth began to fall out, and their gums bled uncontrollably and festered with exquisitely painful boils. Even though they suffered terribly from scurvy, sailors were still expected to work, and if they failed to appear on deck, the bosun whipped them with the end of a rope and then dragged them up on deck, where the sunlight pitilessly revealed their deteriorated condition. Their skin seemed to be falling from their bones, and old scars and sores, long healed, reopened. Their bodies were literally falling apart. Pigafetta put the grim tally of those who died from scurvy at 29, In addition to the sole remaining Indian passenger they had captured, many others suffered grievously. Pigafetta wrote, "Besides those who died, 25 or 30 fell sick of diverse maladies, whether of the arms or of the legs or other parts of the body, so there remained very few healthy men." The intense suffering experienced by Magellan's men could have been prevented by a daily dose of 1 spoonful of lemon juice, for that is the amount of vitamin C necessary to prevent scurvy. A vitamin C deficiency leads to the melting of the collagen fibers and a breakdown in the connective tissues, especially in bones and in dentin, the building block of teeth. Collagen acts as a glue binding connective tissues together, and when it disintegrates, the tissues separate and capillaries hemorrhage, creating black and blue patches on the skin. Curiously, Magellan's men's desperate hope that eating rats would avert scurvy had a basis in fact. Unlike humans, rats synthesize and store vitamin C. While their men suffered and died around them, Magellan, Pigafetta, and several other officers remained mysteriously healthy. Pigafetta marveled, "By the grace of our Lord, I had no illness." Neither he nor anyone else knew why, but there was an outstanding reason why they had escaped scurvy. Throughout the ordeal, the officers regularly dipped into their supply of preserved quince, the apple-like fruit, without realizing it was actually a potent anti-scorbutic. Saved by this fluke, the good fortune seemingly conferred on Magellan by St. Elmo appeared to hold, at least for the present. Pigafetta wrote, "During these 3 months and 20 days, we made a good 4,000 leagues across the Pacific Sea, which was rightly so named, for during this time we had no storm, and we saw no land, except 2 small uninhabited islands, where we found only birds and trees." Their first landfall occurred on January 24th, and very disappointing it proved to be, a simple atoll rising enigmatically from the ocean. Magellan named it San Pablo because the sighting occurred on the Feast of the Conversion of St. Paul. 11 days later, on February 4th, 1521, Magellan spotted another islet, most likely Caroline Island, in Micronesia. The fleet approached and once more tried to find an anchorage, but did not succeed. Unable to make a landfall, they were carried by substantial trade winds over astounding distances. Their progress north was so rapid that they crossed the equator on February 13th. Magellan was utterly confounded by this time. He had expected to reach the Spice Islands long before this point. According to the maps he had studied, he had already covered the entire Pacific and should have been in Asia by now. Worse, he had entered Portuguese waters, as defined by the Treaty of Tordesillas. If he discovered that the Spice Islands lay squarely within Portuguese territory, the finding would defeat the purpose of the expedition, and he could not claim them for Spain. To add to the pressure, he was running out of water, and his men were dying of scurvy. He needed to find safe harbor soon if he was to survive the ordeal of crossing the Pacific. Deliverance finally came 98 days after the fleet left the strait. At about 6 a.m. on March 6, 1521, 2 landmasses slowly rose from the sea. They appeared to be about 25 miles away. Eventually, a 3rd mast came into view. From his perch in a crow's nest 60 feet above deck, Lope Navarro, Victoria's lookout, peered into the indistinct glow, trying to distinguish between these promising outlines and mere cloud formations. Throughout that anxious morning, the ships made directly for the shapes at a rate of about 6 knots. When Navarro was convinced of their true nature, he announced them from on high, "Tierra! Tierra! Tierra!" The shrill cry tore through the silent morning, "Tierra!"